So this is John Richard's real six.
Go back to the name. The name stems from a little town in the Burgenland. There's a town, if you look at it, on the borders of Austria and Hungary, there's a town called Lechnitz. And that's where my family originated from. It's not a common name. And to what I was told when I was a young man, some of my forefathers were a Graf, or whatever you like to call it, supposed to have been. Whether this in fact is true or not, I don't know. But that's where we originate from. It's like a town in Bergen.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about that. So it was Walter
Rechnitzer.
So you're now telling me about this kind lady.
Yes. Mrs. Baggett looked at him and said, well, give Walter a chance to explain. So when I then explained to her what had happened, the way I had to work and I had no pocket money, the only thing they did for me, they bought me the soap, a toothpaste, whatever I needed, but I had no money for myself. And I also told him what had happened, that this farm was in fact a place for people who'd been wrong in Liverpool, they're in trouble with the police. The man suddenly turned around in a different tone of voice, and he said, do you know, he said, you're the second person who's told us this. I never believed anybody before. Now, later I was to learn he was either a director or something of the Quakers. His attitude towards me after this changed considerably. He went out of the office, and Mrs. Baggett then tried to explain to me that I now was in London and I would have to get a job of some description to earn a living, because I had to pay for my board and lodgings at the club. It was called the Knights of Columbus Club at 98 St. George's Square. Anyway, all of a sudden this man came back and he said to Mrs. Baggett, Eileen, I think I have found Walter a job. I looked at him. He said, it's in a chemical place at Blackwall Tunnel. The place is called Cubitt Town Wharf, Blackwall. I looked at Mrs. Baggett, I looked at this gentleman, and I said, where is Blackwall? Where is Cubitt Town Wharf? And what kind of a place is it? He said, it's a chemical place. He said, they're making bromide tablets. It's all powder form. It was distilling this bromide into a powder and making them into tablets. What for? I don't know to the present day, honestly. Anyway, he wrote me all the instructions out. They gave me a certain amount of money, which paid for my first week's keep, and for all my bus fares, for the first week and the second week, to take me back and forth to work. Because, as he said, by the end of the second week, I should have enough money for my earnings to pay my fees. I had to pay 17.6 for my keep. The bus fares came to about 5 shillings, which unfortunately didn't leave me much. Anyway, when I got to this Cubitt Town Wharf, a lot of people were there who were in the same situation. They were old men. I was just a lad. Who were in the same situation as me. And one of the elderly gentlemen who was there working took a liking to me. And every day, to save my money, because he knew what I was getting, he brought me sandwiches in, apple or pear or orange, and something to drink. I enjoyed the job, but suddenly my nose, vessels burst in my nose, and I started to get nosebleed. I went to Westminster Hospital, which is near Victoria. I don't know if it's still in existence now, but it was at that time. into casualty, and they put me downstairs. They got me on this trolley, and they packed my nose with gauze to stop it bleeding. And they thought it would stop bleeding in next to no time. They put ice on my nose. They were all sorts, but it didn't stop. So in the end, he brought my nose, left me there, and I stayed there on my own in his large hospital downstairs, all for hours on end. In the end, it stopped. So the doctor came back, and he asked me what I was doing for a living. Well, he asked me what I was doing. Do I work? I said, yes. Where do you work? So I told him. So he said, well, I'm sorry. He said, but I think the chemicals, the dust, is affecting your nose. You've got two burst vessels in the nose, and they won't heal up. And he left a packet in there. And of course, I was trying to talk, and it always felt like he got cold. We weren't talking the same way. So he said, well, you have to begin your note. And I went to see the. I went up to work because it was due to go to work that morning. But I had the same clothes on, decent clothes, didn't work. I went and told the man, I can't remember who the owner was, but he was a kind of gentleman, a Jewish gentleman, and I explained to him. And he said, well, he said, I'm sorry, he said, I'll tell you what, because you've been such a good worker, I'll give you this week's pay, and I'll give you next week's pay. He said, because you've been good while you're here. Went around all the gentlemen to say goodbye, and they're all sorry to see me go. I went back Kensington, Knightsbridge, Bloomsbury, whatever it was, you know, to the committee's house and saw Mrs. Packard. Oh, she says, why haven't you worked? So I explained to her. I said, but, I said, I heard there is a place in Piccadilly that is looking for trainee chefs. She says, who is that? I said, Lyons. Ah, she says, hang on. Now, I believe one of the Lyons has something to do with the Army Catering Corps during the war. And she phoned Lyons up and she spoke to somebody. I was told to go along to Shaftesbury Avenue and ask for the head chef called Mr. Stanky. That was, I think I more or less had the job if I went there, because what the strings that were pulled. Is it only because I went up to, I got there and I said who I was, yes, Mr. Stanky's waiting for you. Went upstairs to see Mr. Stanky, very tall man, grey moustache. In fact, Mr. Stanky reminded me of my grandfather that used to drive a fiacre. And after that, when I wasn't here, I used to call him Grandad. So one day he heard me, and he said, why are you calling me Grandad? And I told him. And he turned around and he said, well, I feel like it. Which was very nice. Anyway, he was a kindly man, Mr. Stanky. Told me what the job was, what the wage was. I think it was about £2.10 as a trainee chef, which I thought was great. And he said, of course, if you want to work overtime, there's plenty of overtime. But you've got to do it at all. So he then took me in the kitchen to introduce me to the floor chef, Monsieur Briot. Oh dear. He wasn't a kindly man at all, because he did everything wrong, which was apparently the custom in those days. In England, if you did anything wrong, the chef used to come up behind you and twig your ear. But he was a kind old soul, but he had some dirty habits. He used to go in and taste the sauce with one finger, go to another pot without washing his finger, and taste another sauce. And I thought to myself, and he must have heard me one day, because I called him a dirty old so-and-so, and I had a heck of a trip. But it was. Still, that's by the wayside. Anyway, I started a job there with Lyons. Once I started there, I was roped in to do fire watching on top of Shaftesbury Avenue building. All you've got is a meal ticket for it. And I thought, well, I'm doing all this here, and I'm not getting anything for it. But because I started to go up slightly, I was talking to people, you see. And I met a lad there called Lionel Spains. My English was improving at that time. It was getting a lot better. And we got very friendly. We used to walk about together, and when we were not working, I met his mum and dad. His mum was disabled. His dad was disabled. His mum was the breadwinner. And they lived somewhere near Blackfriars Road. I always remember that. Anyway, I think they were looking for lodger, because his dad said to me one day, because Lionel and I were both on the same shift, his dad said to me one day, why don't you come and live with us? It won't cost, how much are you paying after, well, not to, I always said, I'll keep you for a pound. A pound in those days was a lot of money. So when I told him, because when the club found out, well, how much I was earning, because before I wasn't earning enough, they put the rent up. So he said, I'll keep you for a pound. Club does up to £1, 10 shillings, 30 bob. So, okay, so I moved in with him. Lionel and I went to work, and what have you. I became 16. So I had to go and register as an enemy alien. They gave me a little grey book with my photo on. And this desk sergeant said to me, you're 16 now. Why don't you volunteer for the army? I'll give you a letter. Come on up to Euston. I've got all the documents here, I'll show you later on. Went up to Euston and volunteered for the army. Well, in the meantime, I went back to Lionel's house. I always remember, it must have been D-Day, because I heard about it. It was Sunday morning. Yes, it was D-Day. It was 6th of June. Pardon me. I had to go for a medical interview and everything else. And I got sworn in. I got the King's Shilling. I was only 16. I was called up to Blackdown. That's the first time. Off I went to Blackdown. Said my goodbyes, left my job. Had to, because I called in the army. Because, you see, I so badly wanted to get back to Germany. I wanted to kill somebody for what they had done to my family. You see, I'd never heard from my family. I never heard from anybody. Although I wrote letters to my sister to send on the journey to Austria to my parents, but I never heard back. I occasionally heard from my sister, but after my sister died, I suddenly found out, because letters came into my possession. She received letters, but she never let me know. I've got letters in my suitcase, in my little case here, where it says, like my father wrote, why doesn't Walter write to us? What has happened to him?
Did you ever ask her, you know, had she heard?
I did. It broke my heart when I read all this. Why? She never told me. Because she didn't want to know. She cut it all out of her mind. It was a past existence. But I still, inside me, I knew what it was. I knew where the home was, I knew where the family was. You see, it wasn't till 3 years ago, when Poland first became free, that I found out what happened to my mother, and my brother and sister. And it was only after I wrote to the Simon Wiesenthal Institute in Vienna, and I found out that we left Vienna in June, and my father got taken and arrested and was deported to Poland and taken to a labour camp in Nisko. Now, I've heard of all sorts of places, but I've never heard of Nisko. Now, when the Solomon Wiesenthal Institute wrote to me, they sent me a little photostat copy about Nisko. And I've asked people, nobody's ever heard of Nisko. Now, you see, it's so heartbreaking. Anyway, I'll come back to it later.
But you were saying you hadn't heard anything.
I hadn't heard nothing from the army. But I thought about it. I thought, I want to get in the army. I want to kill those Germans. I want to kill those Nazis. Let me be the one. Let me do something. So I knew that the army had made a mistake, because you weren't supposed to go in the army till you're 17. I was only 16, so they called me out. And I went to a place called Blackdown. Now, when I got to Blackdown, I'd done my training. I went up to the Fusiliers Depot Morley Barracks. I'd done my training there. And I was then sent down the South End to a holding place, South End on Sea, Essex, to go out to Europe. We had our kit inspection, everything else. They came up to me and said, "Wow. You're not even supposed to be in the army." So I got all my, I had to hand all my kit in, did everything else, and I became a civilian again. So I came back to London and I found some lodgings just off Belgrave Road. Whilst there, I got to know some of the young people there, and they said to me, "Why don't you come and join the ARP as a messenger boy?" So there was a street, I forget what the name of the street is. I don't think it might have been Alderney Street or something, I don't know. I went down there, I got taken on, and I was there until I was 17 years of age. You see, the army had no dress, but the first 6 months I spent in the army, because I made a mistake, all the documents were scrapped. So I had to start afresh at 17. So anyway, I joined the ARP, and I always remember the first landmine that landed in England. It landed not far from Smith Square. I remember walking along the street. There wasn't a landmine, I walked along along Belgrave Road, and the blast blew me against a railing, and I had my tin hat on, and it was dented. Then, the next one, we were going to Dolphin Square, was along the embankment. I think there were some army chaps living in there or something. And the next one was near Ebury Bridge, and I had to go up there to take some messages, and while I was there, I remember and also with Churchill. And I stood there. I was so proud, and as he went past, I saluted him. I don't know, something inside me thought, well, I'm living in a great nation now. I wish my father and mother were here. That was always at the back of my mind. My father and mother, my brother, my little sister. But it wasn't to be. So anyway, this went on. Okay. Oh, I got a job in the Empire Cinema as an usher. And at the time, there was a film on, Gone with the Wind. I didn't stick it for long because I couldn't work in it. I couldn't stand being in the dark and what have you. So I floated from job to job. Anyway, all of a sudden, my calling up papers came. And I was enlisted in the army. And I had to report to Blackdown again. And When I got there, this Corporal Lomax recognised me. And he said to me, "You coming for a walk?" He said, "Yeah, have a cigarette." I said, "I don't smoke." Anyway, he walked down the hall. He tried to sort of get hold of me. And I said, hey, what's going on?" I think he must have been a little bit, I think he was one of these people who interfered with people.
What, a homosexual?
It must have been, yeah. Because I heard later on in life, he was a sergeant in the prison service at Colchester. And he was caught with another bit of prisoner. So he must have tried it on me, but it didn't work. He kept away from me after that.
Had you had any other approaches as a young boy, with all your experiences?
No. I kept myself to myself. I'll be quite honest. At that age, I was 17. I'd been out with girls. I kissed girls. I snuggled, you know, what you do with girls. But I never had any kind of sexual relationship I think it must have been about 18 and a half years of age.
Also, I'm wondering, you know, through all this time, your arrival in England in 1939, and all the experiences, you know, so many traumatic events, was there anyone who cared and checked up that on your welfare during that time?
Yes, the only one was Eileen Bucket.
But that was much later, yes. Wasn't it?
But you see, before that, I knew about her. But to me, she was just alone. You see, I can understand now why, because wherever I went, I was the bad apple in a barrel of salt. I was a bad apple bad apple in a barrel. I was supposed to have been a bad apple in a barrel. I didn't see it myself. Because I think I was a scapegoat, because I have since heard this from other people. People wanted you, but they only wanted you because they got the money, or they wanted you because they wanted somebody to be the whipping boy to do all the donkey work. This is what I felt afterwards in later life. Anyway.
So really, there was no one, no Jewish organisation, for instance, who really went around and checked that the young people had been put in.
There was, with most of the Jewish people that came over here, there was. I've since heard from other people that when they came over here, maybe my mistake was, I think, when that man wanted to take me, he sent my sister out to be a domestic. Because she said she was only 13, but she said she was 14. But I thought that was silly because she had a passport, but nobody checked on her passport, you see. She went up there as a domestic. He wanted me, and I think I missed out. Because I've since heard that other boys and girls who went into homes, they were adopted, they were treated kindly. Because I think I wanted to be with my sister, which didn't really help me because I wasn't there long. And because I was sent away and I couldn't do nothing about it, I was a lad on my own. There was nobody to check on me. There was nobody I could get in contact. At the time, I didn't know anybody. Till that time that I went to London and I met Eileen Bucket, who helped me later on in life, and I will come to that if we've got time. I knew nobody. I knew them. I did once or twice, all of us at Finchley Grammar School, I had invitation to go to Bloomsbury House to a Christmas party. But I was like a fish out of water. Other children knew each other. I was a boy that went to a party, but I was a complete stranger. I knew nobody. But the other children knew. Yes, I tried to join the games. I knew nobody. What could I do? When I got to London to work, they had my address because of Ireland Market. But again, I went to Bloomsbury, I knew nobody. Again, I was a stranger. Is it? And then, because I'm in company, I feel like my form, I was a young man, an old man, till I was 65 years of age, in the wilderness. I have no contact with any Jewish organization or refugee organization. It is only in later life that I heard about Association of the Jewish Refugees, and I heard about the kinder transport. You see, I missed out on a lot of things because of that. Because I was the Catholic faith was forced upon to me, and when I went in the army, and because of my alien registration book I had, it said on there Roman Catholic, because I stayed in the Catholic Corps. I was treated like a Catholic, but I didn't want to be treated like a Catholic. Nothing against the faith. The only thing I had against it, because I don't like to be forced to go to church. And that turned me against the faith. But I still say, which I think everybody says, if there was a God up there, or is there a God up there, why did he let my mum and dad, my brother and my sister, to be killed and persecuted? I don't know. And I don't think I'm the only one that says that.
So does that mean that you've never really had faith since this time, you know?
It depends what you call faith. I believe, because it's been poured into me in the hereafter. I also think sometimes that when I pass away, when I die, somewhere out there in this great vast universe, because we're told we've got a soul, I'm going to meet my mom and dad, my brother and sister, my grandfather, my grandmother. I believe this. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But this is the way I feel. Maybe some people say, I'm a hypocrite. I don't know. Because I don't believe. I always say this. If a person wants to say his prayers, whichever form it takes, he doesn't have to go to church. If there is a God out there, wherever you are, whatever you do, he will listen to you. You don't have to go to a house of worship. Because I think, honestly speaking, I don't care what anybody says, this is my own feeling. Please don't get upset with me what I'm going to say, because I think the church is a big con. The richest people in this world are the churches. And they only have to make as much money as possible.
Well, I suppose when one thinks of what you've been describing, you know, your experience, particularly of the Catholic Church, was not...
This is the way I feel, because I've been so ill-treated as a boy by the Catholic Church. I feel the Church is there for us. We are the state benefit for the minister. Every Sunday they come around with a begging bowl in the church to upkeep the church, to do this. But then we have learned and we've heard since the Catholic priests who are supposed to be what do they call it? What's the terminology?
Celibate.
They're going off, they're sleeping with women. There's one that's been just recently in Ireland. For years he's been saying mass and taking confession from people, but he's fostered a child and been living with his mother, with his woman. How can you call that religion? They're telling you one thing, they're practicing something else. So all this has gradually turned me against the church.
How about your Jewish faith? Has that changed, do you think, John?
Well, I have never been a practicing Jew as such. I have often wished that when I came to England, I could have been brought up in the Jewish faith. I often wished that I could have been what they call panitzmat, is what the same as they call confirmation, you know. in the other faith, confirmed. But because of circumstances beyond my control, it was never to be. I've met some very kindly Jewish people. I am not a racist. To me, I don't mind that a person is black, blue, white, yellow, whatever.